Welcome back to Behind the Tofu,
a vegan podcast that brings you behind the tofu,
exploring underrepresented topics and issues surrounding veganism. I'm Ashley. You can find me on Twitter at Generally Done.
I'm Seth. You can find me on Twitter at Bolton Bombers.
And go check us out at behindthetofu.com, at Behind the Tofu Podcast on Instagram, and Behind the Tofu on Twitter.
Don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you can.
Awesome. Rama Ganesan is an animal liberationist who takes her anti-caste framework and applies it to animal and human oppression around the globe. She's a published writer on this topic and has produced scholarship.
Sure. I can say at this point that I am much older than you two. So I think that's important to say. I'm going to be 58 tomorrow. Okay. So I have a lot of experiences behind me. The certain things that I've always thought, which I don't think anymore, you know, so it's that's important thing to say. Other than that, well, I was born in India, but I grew up in the UK, but I have been in the US for over 30 years. So
you've been I mean, that's interesting. Do you know why did you move to the United States from the UK?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Not a very good answer. honestly, I got married to my spouse who was pursuing a PhD at the University of Florida.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's why I moved here and we've stayed here.
How have you found your experience here different from the UK?
Yeah, it is actually very different. From the point of view of being an Indian person, an Indian American here, mm-hmm. Versus being an Indian in the UK, I do feel it's very different. Here we have a sort of a racial hierarchy. You know, honestly, I think African Americans are to take the brunt of it, and others of us, maybe Indian Americans or Asian Americans, we're kind of slotted somewhere else in the middle. In the UK, it's not quite so much like that. I was very much in the minority, the immigrant, but I don't feel quite the same over here. Mm. I definitely think we are definitely a privileged immigrant class here in the USA.
Okay, I think I can kind of see the difference. You're saying here there's a racial hierarchy, but over there, you're in a minority, so you have more of a community here, but you're still in a hierarchy, is what you're saying? Is that what you're trying to say? I'm so sorry, I'm just wondering.
No, I think that I don't know whether it's because of the stage of life that I moved here. I do not feel that I have really suffered a lot from being discriminated against. I mean, there is discrimination, okay? But I really see it as being directed towards different people. There are some, but I think it's, and I think we are used as model minorities to get at different groups of people.
Yeah, we're seeing the issues of model minorities, especially when it comes to, you know, East Asian Americans as well. And then I was noticing, so people on Twitter were talking about how there's this disparity, how the United States just passed this Anti-Asian Hate Crimes Act, which is great and all, but then the government is still doing pretty anti-Asian stuff, like about specifically with India, how we're handling the patent about the vaccine pretty poorly. And we also have, you know, lots of the vaccines extra that we're just being we're going to keep them to ourselves. So it's a little bit performative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, especially the COVID situation right now is very sensitive. So definitely agree. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I want to jump into the first question. How long have you been vegan? And has your veganism always included anti-caste overtones, or have you slowly made that connection over time?
Okay. So I've been vegan since about 2012. So almost 10 years. I've been a vegetarian all my life. Okay, so that's a cultural thing. So you might think it's something to do with caring about animals. I might have thought that at one point, but really, I mean, you know, I might have thought it at some corner of my mind, but really it was more to do with purity, you know, like purity, pollution, like eating meat is polluting. And I can tell you because I worked in animal labs, like when I was your age, I was working in animal labs. I was doing animal experimentation. So I did that for 10 years in my 20s in the UK and in the USA. And you know, rats, mice, gerbils, think hamsters, but you know, rats and mice mostly. And when I think, you know, it's pretty horrendous, the things that I was doing, but I was in this very speciesist world and I wanted to do a certain kind of science and that's what I was doing. So, and I definitely didn't feel that I was never, didn't feel, and I was not even told that it was against any principles, you know, that of being vegetarian or anything like, you know, it wasn't about that, you know? So, so, you know, I've been, even though I was a vegetarian, you know, I knew that it really had nothing to do with animals. So I read, Eating Animals, because it was my son, when he was going into college, all the college students were reading Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer. So I read the book along with him. So that was 2011. And so it took me about a year to think about it and become vegan about a year later. And then I had to reconcile with what's going on with being a vegetarian. And I knew that being a vegetarian is about caste, okay? So it's about being in a strata of social hierarchy, you know, a social location of being upper caste in quotes, or privileged caste or oppressor caste, whatever terminology we want to use. The vegetarianism props up that status of being upper caste. And it allows the upper caste to oppress the so-called lower caste people who eat meat. So the intersection is it's diametric. I mean, it's like there are two things that are, you know, in opposition with each other, because we're being vegan to not oppress animals, right? But actually, vegetarianism is really a type of caste oppression, and we can go back into the history of that. Tell me when.
Oh yes, no, please. I would love if you would unpack that a little bit on how vegetarianism is enforcing a hierarchy.
Okay, so quite simply, there are because there are these. Okay, let me talk about the castes then. You know, I know that was you're going to come to that. So there are basically four castes in the caste system. So there's the Brahmins, who are supposed to be the teachers, you know, the spiritual teachers and other kinds of scholars, okay? So they are supposed to be the uppermost caste, they're the elites. Then we have the Kshatriyas, who are the warriors, the kings, the regal status, okay? So the kings and the warriors and so on. Then we have the Vaishyas, who are more merchants and agricultural, like landowners, okay? And the fourth, we have the Shudras, And they are basically supposed to be in service of the other three castes. Okay, so they were kind of enslaved people. And that's not it. And then there's another fifth layer. Okay, the fifth layer is beneath all of them. So the top four layers are called Savarna, because Varna, V-A-R-N-A, is the name that was originally the proto name for castes in the scriptures way back. About 4,000 years ago, it goes back that long, but they call the top four the actual castes. They're called caste Hindus, and the actual name is Savarna. They have Varna, and then there's Avarna, which means no Varna, Avarna, and they are the all the different Dalit castes. Now they're called Dalit. At some point they were untouchable castes, but they are the people who were shunned. Who would not even live in, the community. They'd be living on the outskirts in their own outside ghettos, and they would do all the real menial jobs. You know, if there's anything, if you can think the Shudras are kind of menial labor who are bonded laborers to the other three castes. The Dalits are even lower. They would do all the really objectionable jobs like cleaning, sanitation work in the through fairs, and in the cleaning bathroom waste. Manual scavenging is the euphemistic term. Carting away dead animals. I mean, these are the things that are very, you know, kind of dirty jobs. Dirty jobs, that's what they are. So the dirty jobs made these people polluting, but not just that. It is the fact that they were so ostracized, and they were not even given food, and they ended up eating the dead animals that they were carting away. Okay, and these are, you know, the dead cows. And so that's how they kind of became scavenger meat eaters, you know, but they really need the flesh of dead animals. So that's the basic system that I, in a nutshell. Okay, so I'm going to let you ask me a question before I continue. Is there anything you want me to?
This made me think of a book that I read in undergrad, and I wanted to I just pulled it up just to make sure. Have you ever read Behind the Beautiful Forevers? Behind the Beautiful Forevers?
Forevers? No, I have not.
Okay, this is really for our listeners. This is basically a story. It is a nonfiction story. Basically, it's about what it's like to live in the Mumbai slums. And so it's a story that was written basically like people went, and the author and a bunch of people went to these slums and like literally just like asked for history, like, you know, stories from the people who lived in the slums. And it's a really, really good book, and it explains a lot of what you're saying, like carting away the meat and all that kind of stuff, just like the experience of living there.
Was it written by people from India, or?
I'm trying to see. No, she's an investigative journalist. She's a white person. But it did win a Pulitzer Prize. And I'm fairly certain that she lived in the Mumbai slums in order to learn what was the history behind it. So even though it is written by a white person, it is a very interesting book. And I read it in college. I don't know. Maybe go check it out, possibly.
Yeah. Sounds interesting. Sounds important. So going back to your question, though, about, you know, what does all this have to do with veganism? So, you know, I knew that the vegetarianism was...
Let me ask the question of how it has to do with veganism so that nobody's like, oh, one second. Let's see. How do you draw a connection between being anti-caste and being vegan? Should these ideologies borrow from each other? And how do Brahmins muddy up this distinction in the caste system? We talked about this. I saw this like post on your Instagram where it said that you were saying all this stuff about vegetarianism, like kind of being part of the hierarchy. And I saw that you said that Brahmins are vegetarians typically, but that's just to enforce the caste system. And so that's why I asked that part of the question, but you can kind of ignore that if you want to.
Well, you know, again, I have to like, I'm trying to find out what exactly, no, I think that's an important part of the question. I'll try to unpack it and try to get at what you want me to get at. You know, this whole, and I did ask you guys how you became a vegan, but I assume that it was one day it's like, oh my gosh, you know, we should not be oppressing animals, you know, something like that. So that's what happened to me too. You know, I read this book. Eating animals, of course, I'd say it happened overnight, but really it took a year for me to read about it, understand it. But, you know, it started off by reading that book. So you know, what I'm saying is I was nearly 50 then. So it's a realization that just came to me. So even though I was vegetarian all my life, you know, that had nothing to do with it, right? I was doing these animal experiments, and I was like, I mean, I was kind of a monster. So I was doing all that. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh my goodness, yes, this is how we're treating animals. This is really terrible. And they're just like us. They feel pain just like we do and all this stuff. So, but I knew the vegetarianism had nothing to do with it. And then I became a vegan. So I was living in the USA, and all of a sudden everybody, not everybody, the vegan community was admiring Hinduism, and they were saying, oh, Hindus are vegetarians. Oh, it's about, they care about animals. They think cows are sacred, and they're all ahimsa. And it's not true. It isn't true.
It's so funny because we literally talk about ahimsa so much on this podcast, and you're literally just unpacking that. Like, but ahimsa is a Jainist, it's a Jainist thinking. It comes from Jainism, and Jainism is a vegan framework. So it's not.
We'll come to that.
Oh, okay.
You want me to come to that right now? Let me come to it right now. So, I mean, So I had this whole thing, you know, this is all messed up. And I first thought, oh, it's the white people who are screwing it up because, you know, veganism in the USA is white, kind of white. So, and then I thought about it and I said, what's really going on is that Indian people who live in America, people like me, we tend to be overall the privileged people. And we promote a certain narrative about us, which is actually not the truth, okay? So it's like brand management, okay? Because we're not gonna tell you that we are vegetarian because we consider ourselves superior to certain people who eat meat and we wanna be pure, right? We're not gonna tell you that. So I realized, you know, what is really going on is white people have been on, Americans in general have been told this stuff, and that's why they believe this stuff about us, and it is still happening. Maybe the balloon will be burst in a bit, but it is still happening. But let's go and talk a little bit about the Jainism. Hang on a second though, maybe I should go back a little bit. Okay, so yeah, so the history of what is going on in the Indian subcontinent. There has been this is going back quite a ways. So there's been civilization in the Indus River Valley area, which is kind of a northern Indian area, from about 8,000 years ago. Okay, so that's 6,000 BCE, right? 8,000 years ago. And it kind of flourished. You know, it was one of the biggest communities or cities back in that time. And then over the next few thousand years, it flourished, and then it sort of like dwindled and kind of to nothing. It's not because of anything really like violent invasions or anything like that, more to do with droughts. So by about 4,000 years ago, that would have been 2000 BCE, okay? The Harappan civilization, which is what they were called, Harappan, they'd pretty much kind of dwindled away to nothing, and people had moved away and gotten all scattered, okay, spread out and scattered. At that time, the area was colonized, I guess, by Aryans, you know, A-R-Y-A-N-S, they're called Aryans. They came from the northwest, kind of the Iranian, the steppe region. They were pastoral nomads, okay? So they were horse riders, because the Harappan Valley civilization did not have horses. So they introduced horses. They came on horses and they were pastoral. So they had these cows mostly, but goats and sheep, I guess, which they grazed in different areas, and they took them to, that's what pastoralism is, okay? So they had their pastoral economy. So they ate the cows and goats. The Aryans invaded, I shouldn't say invaded, that's the wrong word. I don't mean invaded, they kind of came and they settled. They settled, that's the word, they settled. So nothing really violent happened. They came and they settled. So this was 4,000 years ago. And then certain things started to happen. The Rig Veda was written in 3,500 years ago, that would make it 1500 BCE, okay? Am I okay with the numbers? You follow me, right? So yeah. I didn't say anything wrong yet, it might happen. So the Rig Veda, which is the earliest so-called Hindu scripture, was written back then. It was written in Sanskrit. And now Sanskrit was not an indigenous language, okay? The settlers brought it in, okay, and it was very different from the civilization that was there before, okay? And the Varna system, the four caste system, started to be described in the earliest scriptures. The other thing about the Aryans is that they were, and really at that point, it wasn't even called Hinduism. It was called Brahmanism. So they called themselves Brahmins. And they that was also a religion that they brought with them. I mean, and they destroyed all the Harappan religions because, you know, they were settlers and they were and their own religion of Brahmanism. And that involved a lot of animal sacrificing, a lot. And we're talking horrendous, like a couple of thousand cows in one go, like that. Horse sacrifices. So if you go back to the Rig Veda, which is the first Veda that was written 1500 or so years ago, maybe a bit earlier than that, you will see horse sacrifice very, very painstakingly described. Okay, so this is a civilization or a community or a pastoral community that is dependent upon cows and other domesticated animals for food. It was dependent upon animal sacrifices and certain other practices. And so the current so-called upper castes or oppressor castes are thought to be derived from this original Aryan community, okay? And genetic tests show, genomic tests show that some of the genes from the Aryans are still present in the priestly castes, the Brahmins of modern day, current day India. So this is the story, you know, this is the story that we're developing and where the patterns are falling into place. So this religion of Brahmanism with certain kinds of oppressions and animal sacrifices, horrendous animal sacrifices, from what I understand, went on for another 1,000 years or so, okay? And a couple of, and people started, what are we getting from this? You know, this has no value, especially when you go from a pastoral community, pastoral way of living, to a more agrarian farming-based society, because then killing cows all the time is not such a good idea, because cows can be used for as labor. You know, you can use their dung for manure. You can use, you know, oxen and so on to pull your plow. So don't kill them. You know, these are too valuable to kill. You know, you can get milk from them. Don't kill them. So, and not just that. I mean, plus it's horrible. And so a couple of other religions, I guess, or philosophies came about, Buddhism and Jainism. Okay. So this was about 1000 BCE that these came about. And they are considered an opposition to Brahmanism, okay? They said, Brahmanism is so horrible and cruel. We are against this Varna system, you know, the proto-caste system. We're against that, and we're against this animal killing. Total liberation, right? Sounds fabulous, 3,000 years ago. But it does sound really good. But of course, Brahmanism over time was also really strong, and it kind of came back with a counter-revolution. So Buddhism never really took off that much in India. In fact, Buddhism kind of got absorbed into Brahmanism, and Brahmanism said, oh, Buddha is actually one of ours. That's pretty much what I want to say. And I want to talk a little bit more about whether Jain is vegan or whether Buddhism is vegan or not. But I want to let you ask any questions about what I've said so far.
We had I didn't know the history of how those religions came to be. And that was really interesting. And I'm glad that you brought the distinction, because I guess that I know that Jainism didn't really start, or they claim that they started before 350 BCE, but that's pretty much when historians generally, you know, understand mm-hmm. when they started. And we had somebody come on and talk about Ahimsa. We had a scholar come and talk about Ahimsa. But I guess, like, in retrospect, what you were saying about how Americans see Indian religions different than Indians themselves do, it's interesting that you said that, because the person that we had come on speak about Ahimsa and, you know, talked about all these religions, even though he is a religious scholar and has been studying these religions for his entire life, he's still an American. So his perspective is going to be different, right?
Oh, but I'll tell you, Ashley and Seth, I mean, what I'm telling you now is not what you're going to get a typical Indian person to say. I mean, this is not it. You will get an Ambedkarite to give you this, like a doctor, and we'll talk about Dr. Ambedkar. It is an anti-caste view because, you know, who tells the history of a nation? Okay. Did you see this TV, HBO series, which I'm really bowled over by? It's called Execute All the Brutes. Please watch it.
No, I've not seen it, but I will put it. We're going to put it in our sources pages for our listeners, and we're going to listen to it, watch it ourselves.
You guys watch it. It's only a couple. It's only like 2 or 3 weeks there. So if you haven't heard of it, you know, and it's HBO because not everybody has HBO, but it's fantastic. And I was so bowled over by it. I'm also reading the book. And in fact, after this podcast is over, I'm going to finish the book today because it's not a very long book. Anyway, the point is, it is about that book, Execute All the Brutes. Execute All the Brutes. It's about how Europeans killed off Native Americans and African Americans brought over here for enslavement and also the Holocaust, you know, in Germany. So it's about all of that. How did that happen? How could we do that to other humans? Of course, now we as vegans would say, how are we doing this to other animals? And that's another step. And sometimes I take that step too quickly. People are like, well, wait, hang on a second, you went too fast. But anyway, it is very important and I suggest you watch it. But the point I bring up, the reason I bring it up here is who gets to tell the story of a nation? And that's what Raoul Peck, who made the documentary, says, you know, who tells the story of America? You know, who makes the history? You know, white people. But then what about the story of the Native Americans? Who's going to tell the story of the Native Americans? So the story you've made about India, you hear about India, or you're going to hear from the oppressor caste people, the oppressors. Those are the stories you're going to hear. So but the story I gave you is not that story.
So that's a really interesting parallel because, you know, we hear about, you know, the colonizers coming to America and killing all the natives, as many as they could. And, you know, we sort of whitewash that history in our education system. And I can
literally thought that General Custer was a good person.
And so that also ties into what I was saying earlier about my Jewish culture is how, you know, we sort of whitewash, as it were, what we've done to the Palestinian people over the years and between, you know, the ethnic cleansing, the land grabbing, the discrimination, the persecution, et cetera. Like
refusing to call it what it is, colonialism. Right.
And so that ties back to what you're saying about who tells the story. Well, I mean, the oppressors are telling the story.
Yeah. And so here I am, you know, I'm trying to dismantle all of this and unpack all of this. So yeah, the story you heard from me, you're not going to hear it from, you know, just anybody. You're going to hear it from anti-caste people.
I appreciate that you're sharing this with us too, yeah. Because I feel like for me, this podcast, I'm always learning something new. And this kind of overrides some of the things that I have already learned so far a little bit. And I like that. I like that I'm, you know, evolving as a vegan and that you're allowing that to happen. You know what I'm saying?
And I definitely appreciate that. And I think, and you know, I've had a chance to talk in a few other podcasts before this, and I wish everybody, all the vegans will know, okay? Not because I really want that. Well, we can talk about what we should do. But some of the things we say about, you know, ahimsa and so on is just so wrong and it's not helping. So anyway, going back to the story. So, you know, this religion came along. They're killing a lot of animals, okay? And so Buddhism and Jainism said, you know, let's not do that and let's not have caste. But that doesn't mean Buddhism and Jainism are vegan exactly. They're not. Buddhism, for example, has a very negative view of animals. It's like, you know, we're kind of animals and then you kind of move up through to rebirths and then become human, okay? So if you behave badly as a human, you get reborn as an animal, right? So yeah, it's very hierarchical.
So would you say that, yeah, it's you would say that Buddhism itself has like hierarchical undertones that...
Yeah. Okay. Actually, if you read the Buddhist scriptures and you don't have to go very far, they use the most horrendous imagery. And I don't want to insult anybody because I do like Buddhism a lot. But if you're a vegan and you're listening to this, oh my God, I mean, they'll say like liberation, you know, like enlightenment, okay? Enlightenment is like you learn to control your mind like a elephant tamer tames an elephant with a bullhook. Wait, what? I don't like that. I mean, that just triggers me, you know, that really upsets me. And I'm imagining, oh my God, I don't want to. But that's, you know, that's only because we have a certain kind of sensitivity now. And you know, those, and you hear stories about how, you know, the mind is all over the place. Like, you know, it's like a monkey that gets his head, one hand caught in a tar and then tries to extricate itself and himself or herself, themselves. And they end up getting the other hand stuck in the tar. And then they put their face down, they get their face stuck in the tar. And that's an analogy. It's imagery about how the mind gets stuck in different places, but that's a horrible image. We don't want to think about monkeys getting stuck. I mean, that is horrible. So, and it would be fair to say it's not vegan in that sense. And a good book to read is Kim Socha's Animal Liberation and Atheism, or is Atheism and Animal Liberation? One of those. Kim Socha. S-O-C-H-A, okay? So there's very hierarchical. And anyway, it's really, Buddhism never really focused so much on saving animals or not eating animals. It wasn't really. And to this day, I know Buddhist communities in Sri Lanka and in some other places, you know, in Japan too, even earlier, they argue about whether they should be vegetarian or not. But it's not about a truly vegan, non-hierarchical view. No, it's about, you know, what is the most, you know, what is the best for us to advance.
So when you talk about hierarchies, one thing that we sort of passed over earlier was, would you consider this position and ideology you have about the caste system, would you consider that to be in alignment with anarchist and maybe anti-capitalist views that we've sort of touched upon a lot within our show so far?
I mean, she told us not to mention anarchism because she doesn't really think that it fits in. But I actually, if you were to listen to our anarchism episode that we just released, you would understand that actually, like, being anti-caste, being anti-hierarchical is anarchism to a certain degree, because anarchism is being anti-
Okay.
Against the hierarchy.
As an anti-caste person, I read anti-caste literature, okay? And they don't really talk about things in terms of anarchy. They might, and maybe if I knew more, I would be able to say that is what they're talking about, but they don't use that word. They don't. I mean, I mean, definitely I'm being radical in other ways, okay? I'm being super radical in other ways, because to be anti-caste, you have to divest yourself of Hinduism, okay? That's what they're calling for, okay? So it's a lot to ask, right? For some people who are totally identified with being a Hindu, it's a lot to ask, but when you look at it, the Hindu, for example, Diwali, you might've heard of Diwali, right? The celebration we have October, November, something like that. And so a lot of other of our big celebrations, they are really, what we are celebrating is defeat of indigenous people. When these conqueror people come along and the settlers come along and they are defeating other people. Okay, so when, you know, Rama, you know, Ramayana, okay, so Rama comes along and he is killing off Ravana. Ravana is supposed to be one of the Asura, or the dark-skinned people who live, you know, in Sri Lanka and South India, that area. Those are the indigenous people. I mean, it's all thinly veiled. That's what we're celebrating. Not just Diwali, a lot of others, you know, a lot of the others. Holy, in fact, you know, most of them. I mean, there are some regional celebrations that are not casteist, but some of the biggest ones, they are casteist celebrations. So this is how we are perpetuating the oppression. You know, some people are born thinking they're asuras. I mean, they are not born. I mean, that's how they're raised. They're raised thinking they are not ideal human beings, and they have, you know, their people were defeated, and that's to be celebrated.
So in the framework of America, and also I guess the UK, if you're thinking, since you've lived in both of these places, both societies have a history of hierarchical thinking as well, right? So the UK had feudalism for a very, very, very long time, and I think that feudalism still it still kind of manifests itself in property rights, which we can talk about on a different day. But how do you see those hierarchies kind of also being similar to mm-hmm. the way that they exist in India, in American right. society, and also in the UK.
Right. I mean, I don't know if America had feudalism, though, because didn't America was after it was.
Well, so America didn't have feudalism, but if we think about the history of the, I'm going to go back to like the Constitution, right? And the way that we gave rights to people slowly over time. So when we first started the nation, the only people who were allowed to have voting rights and the only people who were allowed to do really anything were white property owning men who were Christian as well. So you had to be, even though it was supposed to be anti-religious as a country, you basically had to be a certain person in order to have any power in this country. And so I think that the hierarchy, instead of being ranked necessarily by class in America for a long time, was ranked by your identity as a human being, and still is. But now it, to a certain degree, is kind of higher. It is in class distinctions, right? I would say that like there are definitely huge differences between what a lower class individual right experiences in America than what a higher class individual does. And there's not really a middle class, even though people want to believe that they are part of the middle class. If you make under 150K a year, you are still lower class. Uh-huh. And I, you know, whatever. So what is your kind of perspective on that?
Right. I mean, again, this is when you talked about, you know, who the white male was the ideal person, you know, they're the voting entity and so on. And of course, the series that I talked about, you know, where that I talked about, Exterminate All the Brutes, it talks about all that too. Who is a human? You know, why, you know, who is a human? Why are some other people not human? You know, and so this is all in the last 500 years or so in America. These things happened 4,000 years ago in India. Okay, and I'm not saying they didn't happen earlier in other places either, but yeah, I mean, we had, you know, certain humans, the Brahmin male, and he was the top. So going back to these feudal systems, like, you know, there's a book called Capital and Ideology by Thomas Piketty. I mean, it is a volume, it is huge, but he, and I've read most of it actually, but not all of it, but he talks about how they have this tripartite sectioning of society in so many. So we have the priestly class, the clergy, okay? Then we have the regal class, which would be the kings and the warriors. And then we have the peasantry, okay? So this tripartite division happened in a lot of places. So yeah, and so I wouldn't say that, you know, India was unique. I mean, that we had a unique version of it, but that is how societies were organized still a few hundred years ago.
Yeah, and I think that it still perpetuates itself to this day in the way that we treat, I guess, capitalism, in my opinion, is a form of hierarchy. And we could talk about that again. That's another thing we could unpack mm-hmm. at a different date. So I guess since we're coming, we have about 15 minutes left, so I'm going to go ahead and move on to the next question.
Okay.
And this is something that, of course, could have different undertones. So actually, Seth, do you want to ask this? Because I don't feel like you've asked any of the questions yet.
Sure. So one thing we've talked about only maybe briefly on this show so far is sort of the idea of language as being anti-speciesist. And something you talked about on your Medium article that we noticed. And so there's a lot of speciesist language, even not pertaining to casteism or Hinduism, but just in American culture, how, like, you know, we call cops pigs and we say, oh, kill two birds with one stone. And a lot of this stuff is sort of ingrained in our society. And to sort of think of like the way we talk about objectifying animals. And so when it comes to your perspective, how do you think that we can use our language in a positive manner to speak for just liberation in general?
And I guess, how do we also take that and apply kind of a similar idea of what, not necessarily anti-caste, but like anti-hierarchical thinking right. into our daily veganism?
Right. I mean, the kind of issues that I have, you know, this, with white veganism or Western veganism is mostly about, you know, the wrong visions they have of Eastern religions in India and what they think about us and the general confusions. And I would say that, you know, these people, the Dalits, okay, the Dalits, let's just choose them. I mean, it's bigger than Dalits, but I mean, it's a larger section of of people than Dalits, but choosing the Dalits, they are about 300 million people, 200 to 300 million people who have been convinced or, you know, who have been told that they are polluted. They are, you know, without value. That they should not be educated for, you know, thousands of years, right? These are, and they are, yeah. So, and they've been sold. This is the reason for that is one of the reasons, but I mean, one of the rationalizations for it is that they eat meat. They eat meat, okay? So, and veganism comes along, which is really a Western thing because Donald Watson is a British guy. And, you know, we're all living in the West. It comes along and it just seems like another layer of oppression. Is, you know, I've already been told that I'm polluted. And now because, you know, the upper caste don't eat meat, they eat dairy, but they don't eat meat. But now veganism comes along and it's even more of purity mongering. Okay. And this is, I tell you, the anti-caste spaces are anti-vegan. Understandably, okay. So when you ask me things like, wanting to ask me things like, how do the two things relate to each other? What can they learn from each other? But actually, they are in opposition with each other. Okay. So anti-caste spaces are anti-vegan. Okay. So for example, I'm an upper caste person. I'm an oppressor caste person. Okay. So if an oppressor caste person wants another person wants to show solidarity with Dalits, what would they do? One of the things they might do is to start to eat meat. You got it? So, so the fact that I'm a vegan makes to them, to Dalits and other people that my ancestors have oppressed for millennia, it makes me worse of an oppressor, more of an oppressor, more of somebody who's claiming herself to be superior.
So, I mean, we come across that a lot, and I don't think that, okay, we come across that ideology a lot. People think that vegans are oppressing, especially, I would say, I'm saying from my perspective in the United States, they think that vegans, right, are trying to push our ideology on poor people and people who don't have access to veganism. But in the United States, the people who are the most likely to be vegan are lower class individuals who don't have very much money. And the only reason why we see the idea that it is an upper class thing in the United States specifically is because that is what the people who are in the media that are vegan that we see. But the statistics show that most vegans are lower class people of color in the United States.
Okay, but that's not going to be the same in India.
Yes. Okay. No, I'm just saying, like, applying it to our daily basis. Yes.
It is the opposite, because let's just take African Americans. Okay. There is a history or a tradition of plant-based eating, right? In the African, like Rastafarian eating, right? There's a history of plant-based eating. So, and so to them, plant-based eating seems like decolonizing. Okay. It's decolonizing, but that's not the same in India, because in India, the Aryans or the Brahmins are considered the colonizers from 4,000 years ago. Okay, we were also colonized, not settler colonialism, but we also colonized by British. That happened much later. But we are considered the original colonizers, and we are imposing these rules on them. So for them to decolonize, for the Bahujan is actually a more inclusive word for Dalits and other oppressed people of India. For them, decolonizing is to eat meat, because vegetarianism and the purity pollution thing has been imposed on them. So it is the opposite. I'm not saying there won't be Dalit vegans or Bahujan vegans. There are, but we're talking about, you know, the overall outlook and how people think over there, and that you will see a lot of it. And it's very different. And to say that veganism operates in the same way in India as it does in Europe, you know, in the UK or the US is completely mistaken. It's different over there, and we have to respect the different dynamics. Okay. So going back to who's valued, for example, you can read in the scripture, well, you know, the penance for killing a cow, I'm making this up now, the penance for killing a cow is 10 lashes. The penance for killing a shudra is 5 lashes. A shudra is a person, okay? So something like that. So it doesn't actually, I'm looking for, it's not, the ranking is not so easy to get it as it is in some of the more recent Western literature, you know, how the different races were ranked and so on with animals, the sort of stuff like the Silk and Afko write about. It's not so easy to find, but when you read between the lines, you can see what is valued and who is not valued, and women were not valued at all either. So this is Brahminical patriarchy. What is Brahminism? It's a form of patriarchy that is oppresses women and other people and animals, and assigns values to all these different beings, and they hold themselves at the top.
So how does this kind of, I'm thinking also about Indian animal welfare laws and how they, I'm sorry, so what were you gonna say, Seth?
Oh no, I was expecting you to say that.
okay. Well, I'm very predictable. So India was one of the first countries in the world, aside from Switzerland, which Switzerland's the most wealthy country in the world. So of course they had animal welfare laws, but we can talk about that in a different day. But India had animal welfare laws starting in the 1960s. It's constitutionalized, right? It's part of their general framework for like being anti-animal, whatever. They also have the AWBI, which is the Animal Welfare Board of India, that goes and makes these kind of laws. And my question is, would you say that the reason why those things were constitutionalized and put into the law so early is because the ruling class is vegetarian, and they're trying to impose vegetarianism on other people in the country? Is that what you're saying?
That could be a part of the reason. I would be extremely skeptical of animal welfare in India. Okay. You know that it is the top beef exporter, okay, in the world, or, you know, among the top. I mean, who is one of the South American countries is the top. So it's among the top. There are certain things that go on, but I would be very skeptical. Okay, so basically now we have the beef ban, okay, which the BJP government has imposed, the beef ban. You think it's actually doing something good for cows, but really, what is the beef ban doing? It's to discriminate against people who eat beef, and that is the lower caste people, the oppressed caste people, and Muslims. Okay, the Muslims were other so-called newcomers, in the first millennium onwards, and they eat beef. So the Hindu, you know, the Hindutva right wing, they want, what they're trying to do when they impose a beef ban is to criminalize these other people who eat cows. So it's really not so much about the cows. And these laws, they hurt people. Whether they help animals or not, I'm skeptical.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, like, disclaimer for all of our listeners, animal welfare laws don't help animals anywhere in the world. Animal rights is the only, and this is coming from me as a legal scholar, who's somebody who writes about animal welfare laws all the time. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a system that basically only exists to balance the interest between what farmers want and what individual and like what animals need, right? And anytime that you put animals versus humans, right? So what farmers want versus what animals need, you're gonna end up with the farmers getting whatever they want, right? With the mediators getting whatever they want. So animal welfare laws across the world do not work, because they're just opening up the framework to be like, okay, well, animal producers, what do you want? We want to continue killing them and stunning them and you know, doing these horrible things to them. Okay, well, that's your practices. Oops, we can't do anything about it. Bye-bye. And so animal welfare laws do not help animals, and for the most part are just performative. Mm-hmm. But I'm sorry, I was trying to keep that as short as possible.
Even if there are so-called animal rights laws, anti-slaughter, mm-hmm, laws and so on, they have to be enforced, right? I mean, you know, you so that doesn't happen. And I mean, when they are enforced, I mean, look, I don't know whether you know, but I mean, Muslims and Dalits are getting lynched in India because they're suspected of eating cows.
Okay? I did not know that, no.
Absolutely, I'm sorry. That is such big news. I thought everybody knew, but they are literally getting killed. Okay, and there's also a big distinction. I mean, that's because we are animal rights people and they're making distinctions between cows and buffalo. Okay, you can kill a buffalo, but not a cow. You can kill chicken, that's fine. But you know, I mean, so, yeah.
I'm over here just like deeply upset because I myself am not a speciesist and I don't think that, you know, human lives are above animal lives, but I definitely don't think that it should go the opposite way.
Oh,
we should not be killing human beings because they could potentially be eating animals.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, please look up cow vigilantes, you know,
mm-hmm.
cow lynchings. And it is Dalits and Muslims who, I mean, and when I say Muslims, not even, we're talking about the Muslims who are eking out a living as butchers, which are, because they're also, upper casteism also applies to Muslims in India and maybe other places like Pakistan as well. So yeah, there's Pasmanda Muslims who are the oppressed caste.
Well, that's also, I was going to say, like, I was thinking about also your guys' the Indian social, like the social different, the different laws that apply to different religions in India. And I was thinking about how for a long time, India was the only country in the world that still allowed shalak to be a thing. And that was very anti-Muslim women. I don't know if you guys know what that means. Shalak means divorce.
Oh, the divorce thing.
Yeah, so it means divorce in Arabic, and they could literally divorce their wives and leave them with their children and no money by saying shalak, shalak, shalak three times. And there's different laws for people of different religions for social things. So things like divorce, marriage, children, child rearing, that kind of thing in India. If you want to learn more about that, you can look it up. I'm not going to get into that right now, but sure. They treat different people of different religions differently in India, and sometimes it ends up causing a lot of social issues for those individuals beyond just being lynched and you know treated horribly. There's also that kind of framework happening at the same time.
You know, though, I'm just thinking as you were talking, I'm people are still wondering if maybe you didn't ask me. So if they were like, let's just say we had this Brahmanism and they were slaughtering animals, and then Buddhism came along and said, you know, please don't do that. But they weren't exactly vegan. But how did the upper caste people become vegetarian, right? I didn't get to that part.
No, you didn't.
Let me just explain that. So the theory goes, so because, you know, there's a revolution and then there's a counter revolution. So they had Brahmanism and then they had Buddhism, Jainism, and then this other, and then there's a backlash from Brahmanism. And what the Brahmins did is, you know what, if you guys are going to be all like, don't kill animals, well, we're going to be vegetarian we're going to one up you, you know, we're going to take it further and we're going to be a vegetarian. And so, you know, we used to kill cows because they were kind of special to us because, you know, they were pastoralists and cows meant something. Don't ask me why people sacrificed. I'm still trying to understand. But now, because cows are our animals, we're saying we won't eat them. And if you kill cows, we're going to kill you, or we're going to shun you at least. You know, we're going to kill you is taking it a bit far, but we're going to shun you.
Interesting. All of this is definitely something that I myself am going to apply and like look into more because it definitely. It makes me think differently about some of our past episodes. We've had two episodes where we've discussed ahimsa and where we discussed these religions, and this is definitely a different perspective.
So let me, you know, talk about ahimsa. One thing I didn't also close the loop on is that we talked about Buddhism, and I said, well, you know, it's not really vegan. I mean, I love Buddhism, but you know, it's not really vegan. I talked to Buddhists, and we discussed back and forth. What about Jainism? Well, Jainism is an interesting thing. I mean, it is true that it took more to heart this ahimsa thing, okay? Again, when you go back and read about it, it's really not so much about animal rights as so much as the Jain person wanting to advance to a higher level of being. And so doing harm to another being will affect that Jain person's ability to ascend. Okay, so it's not quite so much really concerned about other animals, as you know. And but the way Jainism is practiced in India now, Jain is a caste. Jain is a caste. It's a Vaishya caste. Jains are merchant. The Ambani, who is, you know, a corporate magnate, is one of the richest people in the world in India, who, you know, he's hugely capitalist, who is, you know, his companies are demolishing, you know, the pristine forests and so on for resources. And so he's a Jain. He's a Jain. So Jains are the merchant class, okay, caste. I don't want to say class. They are caste. And you know, they practice caste. So, you know, that is not total liberation. This is the thing, you know, there are these, and I have this couple of really good quotes, and I'm going to see if I can find that. Let me find, this one is Dr. Ambedkar's quote: "Do not keep contact with those who feed ants with sugar, but kill men by prohibiting them to drink water." Okay, Dr. Ambedkar, he was a social reformer. He was a Dalit freedom fighter. Lawyer economist, kind of like you, Ashley, I guess, in the earlier 20th century. And this is what it is. You know, Brahmanism is about taking care of, I'm going to feed you, your aunt, but I'm going to prohibit this man or this woman from drinking water. And so Dr. Ambedkar, he led this Mahad Satyagraha, where they went into a well. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, in the USA, we had, you know, segregated water fountains. Okay, so this well is going to be polluted if a Dalit drinks water out of it. So he marched, and they took water from there. And of course, everybody was really mad and throwing stones at them and, you know, threatening violence because they took water from this well. And afterwards, they had to purify the water. Do you know how they purified the water in the well? By adding cow poop and cow pee to it, because cow poop and cow pee is considered purifying. I know, by your expression, like, what is going on? I'm telling you the truth. Let me read you another really good quote by Bhagat Singh. "Hindus can worship beasts, but can't let a human being sit next to them." So this is what we're dealing with when they say worship beasts. You know, we are, you know, the Hindu gods, we have Hanuman, who's a monkey, and so on. We have Ganesha, who is an elephant head, you know, elephant head god. So we have worship beasts, but yeah, they won't let a person sit next to them. They won't let a Dalit sit next to them because they will be polluted. That's precisely what it's getting at. So this is what we are dealing with in India, okay? This is the history of what we're dealing with in India. So when veganism comes along, does it make it look worse? Doesn't it look a bit like that?
My last question before we close out, because we're almost done, is even though all of this, even though in India specifically, you have veganism being something that would be, right, another caste imposition. I'm so sorry. Be another caste imposition. Do you think that Americans and people in the UK and people in Western countries can still use the ideologies and the religion portion, I guess, of Hindu and Jainism to do that? Or do you think that it's still okay?
Absolutely not. Okay. Absolutely not. Because caste is embedded in Hinduism. This is what I'm reading. Mm-hmm.
That was my question. Yeah. That's what I wanted you to do. I wanted you to go off on this.
Absolutely don't. It makes no sense. I mean, look, there are these hundreds of millions of people who have been wronged by Hinduism and in some pretty horrible ways, in some pretty horrendous ways, and it still continues to this day. Okay. And I can't even compare with I don't want to get into that, but I mean, I can't even come up with anybody else who would be similar to the extent to which some of these peoples have been oppressed over millennia and still are because of their history. So it's wrong to say this is all about ahimsa when the religion is responsible for their oppression. Where's the ahimsa? Now, some people who are devout Hindus, they're going to get upset with me saying that. But what I'm doing is I am reading the anti-caste literature and I'm giving you that. That's where my thoughts come from. And they're not my ideas. I'm reading Dr. Ambedkar and other people like him who say, if you want to be anti-caste, you have to divest yourself of Hinduism. Okay? So Where are you? So I am saying I was born a Hindu. I'm even an upper caste Hindu. I've got all this privilege and stuff like that. But I'm saying, you know what? I'm going to not be a Hindu anymore. Okay. So I was born a Hindu. I've done some very important ceremonies and so on to further perpetuate Hindu practices. But I'm saying, you know what? I don't think I should be a Hindu anymore because I want to be anti-caste. Now, it doesn't make any sense for me to say, yeah, you know, vegans should go and promote Hinduism. No, I'm not a Hindu anymore.
I wanted you to go on that to kind of finalize the point at the end of the episode. Okay. That's what I wanted.
I can say that I'm a Hindu and I can say that. And Buddhism, I have great respect for. It still has issues. Jainism has issues as well. Again, you know, people are going to be mad at me for saying that. But, you know, we have the evidence.
All right. Well, do you have anything you want to promote or anything, final wisdom? I guess you just gave your final wisdom. So do you have anything you'd like to promote for our listeners before we go?
Promote. Oh my gosh. You didn't ask me about promoting. I did, you know what? There's a couple, I did note a couple of things I want to say. And I want to maybe just mention that. Okay. Even though I've been vegetarian all my life, I've never eaten meat, you know, it's not because Brahmins think, being a vegetarian is the healthiest way to be. Actually, we're vegetarian for ascetic reasons, you know, something we give up. Actually, and so because we are the scholars and the teachers and so on, we don't do any manual labor, okay? And so we don't need to be strong and muscular. But the so-called lower caste people, they do manual labor. So that's why they eat meat. So even though I can tell you this just because I have been vegetarian all my life, doesn't mean we think vegetarian is the best diet. You know, in India, they don't. I mean, what else? The other thing, I guess I don't want to promote it, but I wanted to say it. One thing I've been talking about and I'm going to be thinking about more is, you know, the sexual politics of meat, the Carol Adams book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, that talks about meat as masculinity and so on. Well, that doesn't work with me. Okay, that's not true. For us, vegetarianism is not power so much. It is superiority. Okay.
Well, yeah. So that kind of shows our listeners the dichotomy between the way that Westerners think about, or the way that Americans think about it versus the way that Indians might think about vegetarianism and veganism. So it's a different perspective. And definitely when you're reading Sexual Politics of Meat by Carol J. Adams or anything that has to do with the feminism aspects of animal liberation, remember that it's in a Western framework, right? And it's coming from a Western perspective from a white woman.
But I mean, except she doesn't say it like that, though. I mean, unfortunately, the book doesn't say enough.
Yeah, she doesn't disclaim that. I recently read it myself. I have some reservations about it, but I'm not going to get into that now.
Okay, I mean, that's a long story. But it's not even that I'm finding out because I've been watching the show and also listening to other people. You know, Hitler was a vegetarian, and we say it as a joke, but it's actually true. Okay, and some of the literature, the scholarly literature about Hitler's vegetarianism, also talks about this dichotomy between purity and certain kinds of power and how it relates to eating meat and so on. The final thing, I guess, I would like to leave you with, and I'm happy to have this opportunity with you, but you know, I am an upper caste privileged person, and so definitely when people want to follow up more, I would go for and anti-caste voices and there's more and more out there now. There's many pages, you know, social media pages. There's organizations such as Equality Labs. Equality Labs is a very good resource for people to go to. Good articles in there. Another person that you should not necessarily reference is Arundhati Roy. Okay, she is considered an upper caste person. And so she's appropriating some of the Bahujan struggles, and so they are really angry with her. They're really upset with her. So please don't go there. I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't read her, but she is not considered the voice of the anti-caste movement. She's not.
Yeah, so like always, make sure that you listen to the voices of the people who are going through the struggles. Thank you, Rama, for coming on our podcast. It was really awesome to get to speak to you and get to hear your perspective. Seth, do you have anything you want to say before I say goodbye to our listeners?
No, just echoing what you said. I really enjoyed listening and learning a lot today.
Awesome. And this has been Behind the Tofu.